Yeah, we're back for another episode of Powers and Principalities. Principalities and Powers. Powers and Principalities. This is what, our 53rd episode?
53rd. So yep.
Over a year now.
I know.
So,
and it's getting better and better. not hard to imagine, but.
Well, this week we wanted to discuss the role of comedy, humor, in the whole scheme of things. Humor. How is humor used? I mean, I was thinking recently humor, some of the comedy shows, late night comedy shows, what we found out was I think last year with the WikiLeaks information that Stephen Colbert was his show, The Colbert Report, was a of course, which I think apparently is a prime source of news for millennials now. This sort of this sarcastic, witty look at the news, and this started with with Jon Stewart, because he's I think he started out on Jon Stewart's show when he was the host of The Daily Show. That's a whole another show. Probably also coordinates with the with the powers that be. But the WikiLeaks revealed that Colbert and his team at Comedy Central were making episodes at the request of the Clinton Global Initiative back in 2013 in support of the campaign. And so that kind of revealed how people look for these comedians, look for these, especially ones that are politically oriented comedians, to use comedy to perhaps to mock and shed some truth on, shed some light on the political system, bring these people down to earth so much. But often comedy has been used, it's been said that comedy is a way you can tell the truth without getting killed. But I don't think comedy really functions that way, at least not in the United States. It's very controlled. It's not really that biting, if you really look at it. And so what did you make of that when that story about the Colbert was coordinating with Hillary Clinton and her campaign?
I think that it was not a surprise. I mean, I would be amazed if the coordination isn't even deeper. I think, as far as links to the DNC, I suspect that like Jon Stewart and Colbert are linked right into the secret society. I mean, they are lifetime actors.
Mm-hmm.
And you have sex symbols or different ways of creating idols, people who have influence, can create culture. And one of them is, the comic. It's like you say, he can talk about, or she can talk about things which are unusual, and most people won't talk about them. So the comic has the potential to get into subjects that are what, I would call edgy. In other words, the edge of the avant-garde. This is where culture is getting transformed. And so I think that people really need to pay attention to comedy and comics, because they are just very powerful culturally.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, is the a lot of people get their ideas and their news from these sources more so than ever. I noticed this, I think I mentioned this to you in an email, that Saturday Night Live had a skit with, of course, Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump, President Trump.
I lost you.
Can you hear me?
I lost Tim.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, but I lost you for a second.
Oh, okay. I was saying how Saturday Night Live a couple weeks ago had a skit with Alec Baldwin playing, of course, President Trump, but they actually had Stormy Daniels on. to do the skit, because this supposed scandal, her, where he apparently has, you know, used her services at some point. There was a some sort of confidential agreement non-disclosure agreement that was struck. Money was paid, which might violate some campaign finance laws. Apparently, this is a story would have broken around 2016. Apparently, during the campaign. So that's the scandal. If people really care about this, I think post Clinton, I don't understand how people get too upset about this. But anyway, it just struck me that you had, of course, that the media uses her stage name, which is Stormy Daniels. I think it's like Elizabeth Clifford or something. It's a normal name, but they keep pushing her professional name. You know, yeah. And it's just to degrade things further. And the same that they, in the midst of this litigation, they actually had her on during a skit. It's as if back in the late 90s, Saturday Night Live would have invited Monica Lewinsky on in the heat of, in the middle of the scandal. Little litigation. It just shows how they're using comedy to fuse reality with fantasy. And it's just struck me that, you know, that was occurring. And then, and I guess this becomes news in and of itself. So the news, you know, these comedy shows, the skits and the impersonations become news stories, which used to not be the case. I'm old enough to remember the old days, you know, back in the 80s with Saturday Night Live and the political humor, late 70s and 80s, and just wasn't that way. It wouldn't have taken time on a news report. So it's a change in the media again. So,
yeah, I think that if you look at the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, by the American Jewish Committee, which, you know, leads directly into the Macy Conference and then on into, you know, the MKUltra and the counterculture creation. If you look at, you know, that chapter 23 where they outline the future, they talk about Eros, how they're going to use Eros as propaganda. They're going to use it on a mass scale. It's going to be like the propaganda that fascists use. It's going to be that powerful. But it's going to be, you know, fun. It's going to be sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But the fact is that you know, the comic is always part of the cultural transformation. And I wanted to, you know, go all the way back, and I hope our listeners aren't getting bored of me mentioning this guy, but Gregor Luchas, because, you know, when he ran the culture in Hungary, you really got a chance to see the future of the Gentile, basically. Because Luchas, you know, he had two components. You know, he had degraded sex education, you know, which was just an out-and-out attack on marriage and on family life, and also the promotion of, you know, hypersexuality. But then he also had the afternoons. They would take the kids and they would give them fairy tales, dream world, right? So this was, you know, basically Eros. You know, they're going to use this kind of propaganda. Here it is. Luchas is implementing the plan in 1919, and this is, you know, 30 years before the American Jewish Committee, you know, wrote the authoritarian personality. But what I would hope everyone does is if they get a chance, is read the basically the Luchas's letters are published in a few places, and you can actually then, you know, see exactly what he is advocating and the kind of propaganda he's doing, because you can then go, Tim, to a little bonbon video that's on the internet called Bimbo's Initiation. Bimbo's Initiation is really important. It's one of the very first cartoons. It was created by Walt Disney and Max Fleischer. So you have this strange combination again of a Freemason Disney and a Jewish guy, right? I mean, how do they get along? Why does this pattern appear so often? But in Bimbo's Initiation, it's the first cartoon representation of Mickey Mouse. So, and the point I want, I'm hoping people will actually, you know, take the trouble to do, is you can see at the end that Bimbo is seduced into becoming a Freemason, to becoming under control, right? You know, to swear allegiance to the group. And you have all these Masonic, you know, black and white square floor, and the number 13 is everyone in Skull and Bones, and the group that has Bimbo captured has candles on their head, you know, they're Illuminati, you know, it's very, very crude, and it doesn't really even hide, you know, what's going on. But point I'm trying to make is, then you have the character Betty Boop, who actually started out as a dog in cartoon life and then became a sexy human. But she comes in and does a very risque dance, right? Now, what I'm saying is that this is supposed to be funny. It's a cartoon, right? If you look at how it's set up, how the characters are set up and the events of Bimbo's, you know, how he goes through the initiation, it's supposed to make you laugh, right? But look at it through this perspective of it being part of Gregor Luchas' project, right? That's the thing I would hope people see, is that when you have, you know, the humans made into animals and degenerate sexuality as a tool, you're looking at a cartoon representation of Gregor Luchas' plan. And then when you go forward, you know, as to when Mickey Mouse gets a home, Disneyland, then you can easily understand why the CIA was so involved with the creation of Disneyland, and also the Disney, the Mason, Walt Disney, put Club 33 right on Main Street, sort of in your face. So anyway, this is what I hope people will basically try to understand about comedy, is that it's a very central component of how the oligarchs create legacy, but it's also about, it's one of the really strong elements of their propaganda. I mean, and that's why you have the Magic Kingdom and the cartoons. I mean, this is all, it's Gregor Luchas's plan, right? It's the fantasy, the human animal side of it. It's going to link up to pornography as American culture, you know, gets degraded. But these are components of an attack on Europeans. I mean, I really don't see how this can be contested. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, obviously you're going to gradually introduce these things, and you know, it's something's benign as a cartoon, and then there's the joke, you know, the mischievous joke, the the off-color joke, something like that, and that's how you sort of introduce these things. It's almost like how the in the 1950s the hula hoop was introduced.
Yeah,
this comes across as something very innocent, but yeah, what is it doing? Obviously, it's causes the females who primarily used it to swivel their hips in these things, and it's, you know, and nevertheless, it's an important step to changing the culture. Same with the music; have the music gradually change. You know, Chubby Checker do the twist in these things, and so it's going to be introduced through the medium of entertainment and music and cartoons and these things. But if you look at some of I read an interesting article about actually the article is entitled "Hollywood's War on Ethnic Catholics," but the article is about the movie Caddyshack, and it was written by Jesse Russell, a gentleman I interviewed not too long ago, and he pointed the article to me, and it's about Caddyshack, what it represents, and he goes, "There are innumerable films, songs, and TV shows produced during the demise of the WASP establishment. There's one movie that is emblematic of the attack on ethnic Catholic families and contains all the ingredients of the spiritual poison that prevented the emergence of the truly Catholic moment of political and cultural power in America, 1980's Caddyshack. Although containing many side-splitting, hilarious scenes, Caddyshack is a full-frontal attack not only on WASP culture, but on ethnic Catholic Americans. I'll shoot ahead. In the film, the owner of the country club, Judge Elihu Smales, ironically played by the Polish-American Ted Knight, is the emblem of patrician-come 1970s tacky waspishness. Dressed in brightly colored polos, the uptight Anglo-Saxon Protestant angrily ambles across his golf course, venting his repressed emotions on family members and colleagues alike. George Smiles, stereotypically, like many WASPs who lost control of their country in the latter 20th century, is disgusted by the shabby, crude, ethnic interloper at his country club. But is now straitjacketed by the anti-discrimination laws from preventing them from entering his club. In Caddyshack, Judge Smales is contrasted with the nouveau riche real estate developer Al Cervic, played by the talented Rodney Dangerfield. With his relaxed and generous, easygoing demeanor, Dangerfield's Cervic stands for either the cool new Hollywood glitterati or the nonchalant, liberated ethnic Catholic from Michael Novak's The Unmelted Ethnics. Let me go here. The message is clear. That the ethnics who had been kept out on the outside of American society have broken in, and now with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and a new American is coming out of the rubble, freer and happier than the stiff upper lip, Bible believing society that there too existed. But Caddyshack is not just about seeing the beard of the WASPs ushering in the Aquarian age of free love and festive music. As much as it is an attack on Yankee Protestant culture, Caddyshack is an assault on the ethnic Catholic family. The caddy of Caddyshack is Danny Noonan, a quiet, slightly morose Irish-American teenage boy with big dreams to win the Caddyshack scholarship at the country club and go to college. Danny, like one of the film's screenwriters, Brian Doyle Murray, is a stand-in for the ethnic Catholic born during the sexual revolution and his wicked sister, Vatican II, who never had the immigrant experience or the ethnic Catholic life. Authentically Catholic life. The plot of the film is basically Danny's choice to either follow the path of the pristine but cruel neurotic WASP, represented by Judge Smales, or become assimilated to embrace the degenerate, free-spirited counterculture of Al Cervic and others in the film. Either way, Danny has to leave his own allegedly repressed ethnic Catholic culture. As a supposed example of the suffocating environment of his Catholic family, we see Danny's house is full of parading Irish-American children at the beginning of the film, giving the sense of an overcrowded, stifling Catholic house led by parents who need to learn about the wonders of population control and the newly invented pill. In contrast to the strict home life, the country club Danny is initiated into a world of sex, drugs, and good times that his Catholic parents denied him. The message of the movie to the ethnic Catholic is perfectly clear. Abandon your faith and heritage and become an American, but become the right sort of American who has a casual intercourse, uses drugs, is crude, and has no sense of loyalty to his family. Ethnic Catholics, for the most part, took the bait from Hollywood, and the wasteland of doubt, divorce, and lonely addiction is now the price we have paid, for it is our religion, our culture, have become the Disneyfied character of themselves. So I thought you might enjoy that.
Yeah, no, and it's well written, and it certainly is correct. In that movie, haven't seen it in a while, but I would completely agree that Dangerfield, the character Rodney Dangerfield plays, he's just having a lot more fun with life, with mm-hmm. his, he's obviously Jewish, but he is, he makes kind of risque comments all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's part of, he's basically, a representation of sexual liberation. I mean, Sigmund Freud could have written this character, right? And then the other thing that was always interesting to me is Bill Murray, because he played a degenerate, kind of an imbecile groundskeeper who battles a gopher. And my point is that, I'm surprised that someone like Murray, who's supposed to be Irish, right, would not see that his character was basically denigrating Irish culture mm-hmm. in general. Because even though he's very funny, and it's just, Murray is quite hilarious in it. But his personality, the personality he plays, is so degenerate that it has to have a subconscious effect on the people who look at it. It's just saying Gentiles are wastrels and stupid, right? Mm-hmm. And I always wonder about Murray, the whole Saturday Night Live cast. I've wanted to get DNA there backing him up.
I'm sorry, Joe, you knocked it after DNA.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I lost your connection. I'll edit that.
Hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you fine now. You just went black. Now I got you back.
Okay. Sorry. Okay, so my point is that Murray, I just am puzzled by and wanted to, I'd love to have a DNA test of the guy just to see what is his real background. I'd like to see what kind of Irish he is. So he came here to Santa Barbara. He had a one-man musical show that he was reading excerpts from various writers, and I thought that the kind of stuff he was reading seemed a little peculiar to me. But then what was really interesting is that the title of the show was New Worlds, and that's always a bit puzzling to me as to why he would be attracted to that phrase. And he was dressed as an undertaker. So I could well be paranoid here, Tim. I'm often accused of it, but the people who become celebrities, particularly comics, you really do need to look at them closely and try to imagine if they're cultural weapons. Like, for example, the character Lenny Bruce,
mm-hmm.
right? The heroin addict, sexual degenerate. He was really instrumental in the whole onset of pornography. And people kind of forget this about him. But he had very famous obscenity trials.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because he would use words and his act would describe events, sexual events. He was defending it on freedom of speech, right? And so this was a comic leading culture, basically off a cliff, and it was coinciding with all of the other elements of pornography creeping into our culture. But the what was leading it in, the two things that led pornography into American life were, in general, were Lenny Bruce. He was really the first famous, basically obscenist, he was proud of his obscenities and defended them as free speech. And of course the Holocaust, because if you look at, when you had large productions, popular films that had topless women, it was after World War II when they started to produce films about the Holocaust, and the Holocaust was such a powerful force that, the Hays Code was simply abandoned. And then, you started to start to see in these films that were about, like, the pawnbroker.
Yeah, the pawnbroker, yeah.
It was about the Holocaust, or it's a theme. And then you have the scenes with women's breasts, and so off you go. So the avant-garde, right, the cutting edge, the thing that's as actually, slicing into culture, often has a comedian. And so people need to really pay attention more to the effects of people like Lenny Bruce and Walt Disney and Max Fleischer, and try to basically stop them by calling them on it, by making people aware. I think that when you start getting into, like, Colbert being a political operative, that's it's a useful step, but really, people have to go a little bit further and start looking at this as a giant MK Ultra project, where all of these, like the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, he was a lifetime actor.
Mm-hmm.
He develops trust because he has this great kind of funny way of talking about the world. There's so many, he makes people laugh, and he's very often, he's the reasonable person. Right. So he develops a lot of trust, and then 9-1-1 comes along, and he basically, suddenly it's the gloves are off, and now he's, all of his trust is being used because he's one of the things that stops, the 9-1-1 movement from really taking over the country.
Yeah. Same thing with characters like Christopher Hitchens or Noam Chomsky, these supposed,
Yeah.
Reliable critics, outside the mainstream, and it turns out they're not. They're all very well paid, and they're all very much controlled, and they know who their paymasters are. And when push comes to shove, they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them.
Well, like, here's a funny story. This is a laugh riot. I went to a Noam Chomsky lecture. It was right here in Santa Barbara, right across the street from my house, just about. Walked over there. There was old Noam, and I went with my wife, and who's kind of a from the South, and manners are very important to her, part of her culture and background. And so we sit down. We're pretty close, maybe about 50 feet from Noam, and he's introduced, and this guy comes out and he starts describing Noam. He's gonna like give an introduction, and he goes, Noam Chomsky, for 50 years, has been speaking truth to power. And I just started laughing. Couldn't stop it. I was like, and my wife was absolutely livid. And it led to, she says, from now on, you're sitting across the room from me, that, we're not getting any of these. I said, I'm so sorry. I just couldn't help myself. The idea of a guy, who talks about 911 as like, well, weird things just happen. I mean, he's described as somebody who's talking truth to power. Oh God, it just cracked me up. So that's, see, this is the other side of comedy. Comedy can be very liberating, right?
Yes.
Because if you can start laughing
It's a
at
tonic. It's
some
a
stuff,
tonic, yeah.
yeah, then because, Tim, here's the thing, is that the comedy of people like Jon Stewart, Colbert, Lenny Bruce, Disney, it all works to create intimidation. It creates a kind of sense of what's normal and proper, right? The jokes are structures. They kind of show where, like you can't make jokes about the Holocaust. You can't make jokes about Jewish people, right? I mean, like if you look at Caddyshack, Dangerfield is kind of a lampoon, but he's definitely lovable and endearing, whereas, like the WASP characters are kind of mean-spirited, right? So you can see there's just this subtle, endorsement of that personality, and to the expense of, the way the people who look at it, then we just get structured in these things. And so if we get to the point where we can start laughing a little bit about them, hopefully that'll help with just getting rid of some of the intimidation, so we can think and speak more clearly.
Another movie, a classic movie, comedy, romantic comedy, they call it. Is of course The Graduate, and you probably remember this well. I remember from my youth watching it, and it really is a remarkable movie, well produced from that era. The soundtrack, the scenery, this even how it's filmed, the lighting and everything, and great acting in these things. Of course, The Graduate stars Dustin Hoffman as Benjamin Braddock, supposedly a WASP, but obviously Jewish. The way he his appearance, and it's obviously the movie. Overtly, movies about sort of the emptiness of American life, particularly WASP American life. It's a swipe against WASP society. He's an upper middle class WASP family, and how he has an affair with his father's business partner and best friend's wife, Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft. It's been come to be understood as particularly a Jewish movie. But even it was adopted by Jews as a Jewish movie, because ultimately they figured it what it really was about. It was about being Jewish, how to be Jewish in a dominantly Christian society. But nevertheless, it was an assault upon basic values and decency. Now,
Sure.
remember when I saw the movie, my reaction was that I watched it like I watched one might watch a car wreck. It was interesting, but you don't leave the movie admiring Benjamin Braddock, Dustin Hoffman's character. You're more or less disgusted by it. Of course, it ends with the Dustin Hoffman, the interloper, the Jewish interloper in many respects, stealing the Gentile
Yeah.
girl,
Yeah.
the shiksa from a church, literally
Right.
pulling her from a church and
Yeah.
running off onto a bus, and that's how the movie ends. So any, I mean, I saw this movie as sort of, again, one of these classic 60s, early 70s comedies that were assault on WASP society. And it was,
Absolutely. It's what it was. I mean, and I mean, I don't, I I think any other kind of sort of understanding just is silly. Of course, that's what it was. I think Mike Nichols directed it.
Buck Henry, yeah, who was a deracinated Catholic, I think.
Yeah, I don't know, but Anne Bancroft was Mrs. Robinson. She's Mel Brooks' wife.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know. It just, I thought it was that if we sat here and went through the plots of, like, say, just take 50 films at random that are well known over that period from, say, 1970 to 2000 in that 30-year zone, 98% of them would project American Gentile culture as basically neurotic and chaotic and not as a fun place to be.
And empty. And empty.
Empty and soulless. And, yeah. You know, one of the things, again, in getting to comedy was All in the Family, mm-hmm. where you had Archie Bunker. You know, he's sort of lovable, but he is a racist. You know, he basically is very small-minded and petty.
Mm-hmm.
And this was sort of the representation at that time. And Norman Lear, of course, the Jewish director writer was created that and did most of the directing of it. So, but that was just very characteristic. And then, but if you go back, say, 20 years from that, and think about how Gentile families were represented, like in the 50s, like mm-hmm. with Leap to Beaver and Father Knows Best. I mean, there was no ridiculing of, well, very little ridiculing of the Gentile father, mm-hmm. And they didn't, or at least there were a lot of shows that characterize the family as being wholesome and kind of having a real value to it. But you could already see that from the propaganda side, they were moving toward the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? It wasn't, that didn't start, you know, with the Summer of Love. I mean, this project had been going on, well, since Gregor Luchas, but it was, you know, when World War II ended, it really got into another gear. And so it just, you know, you had traditional families represented, but they were just going to become fewer. Talking about...
We got cut off. We're back. Okay.
I was talking about Archie Bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, you know, he was just a way to steer people away from, particularly Gentiles, away from the idea of family, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he's the butt of all the jokes, and you weren't seeing this like 30 years earlier. So clearly comedy was being used as an avant-garde and, you know, it was strange in that, you know, Norman Lear is Jewish. He's giving this vision of the Gentile family as, you know, pretty negative. And that you wonder, well, why is he never called on grounds of racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, it's like if you had all in the Jewish family and you were a bunch of Gentiles and you made the male Jewish father the butt of all the jokes and he was cruel and rapacious, you know, just a really negative person. I mean, are you kidding? B'nai B'rith would just go through the roof. So how come, you know, you can, you know, someone like Norman Lear can not just ridicule, but smash, you know, kind of European culture? Why weren't people calling him on it when that was going on?
Well, because they're the ones that practice critique and deconstructionism, and while they can carry that out against Christians, the turnabout is not fair play, and therefore you can't do that to them back. So,
yeah, didn't you have like recently an experience with you were discussing freedom of speech, and the relationship, you know, the Google and Facebook. And then you put out a YouTube video that was like censored.
Yeah, they've it was B'nai B'rith, B'nai B'rith, ADL B'nai B'rith, and part of the discussion I think talked about how their efforts coordinating with ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center, coordinating with outfits like Google and Facebook and censoring and stifling free speech. And so that was just part of the discussion, and then lo and behold, the video becomes it becomes restricted, so comments are shut down, people can't share it. There's a warning on it that says it's inappropriate and offensive or something, so to people's sensibilities, I suppose. But that's so much for that's YouTube.
Yeah, well,
so, that's, you know, it's like, yeah, irony there, huh?
Yeah, it is a little ironic, I would say, you know. I mean, but it's funny, you know. So, you know, you can trace the kind of the nature of the comedy as avant-garde. And so I would think today,
free speech can be used to deconstruct and tear things down, which is what they kind of, a lot of these Jewish intellectuals and comedians embraced in the 60s, like Lenny Bruce, is free speech.
Yeah.
But free speech cannot be exercised to protect institutions or build things up. You see, that's
right. Yeah. Right.
It's selective tolerance, you know.
I guess it is. I mean, and then like in the current era, I think one comedian that I really see as like cutting edge is Alicia Silverstone.
Not Alicia Silverstone. You're talking. She's
I know. No, I'm sorry.
Sarah Silverman. Yeah. Sarah.
I'm
Silverman.
Sorry. Yeah. I can't.
Right. She's the actress. Alicia Silverstone. The other one is
right. Sarah Silverman. Right. Yeah. And I have seen her on television and seen some of her acts, you know, material, and it's just viciously racist against Christians. Mm-hmm. I mean, she actually hunts them down with her jokes. You know, she'll basically go out of the way to you know, just talk about how degenerate the culture is. And it's interesting because, you know, if you go back 50 years, I think the same ideas are being expressed, but they're done so subtly. You can't really, you know, see the attack as, you know, bold face, but with Sarah Silverman, it's just completely, it's all that she does, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, she says that she's really not religious, but she did go to the Western Wall when women lit menorahs there for the first time. And so that's sort of interesting. And she is really degenerate. She put out a video with Matt Damon, right? And it was about having sex with him behind her boyfriend's back. And it was a duet with Matt Damon. And so, you know, here we are, the old ridicule the Gentile and promote sexual degeneracy. I mean, that's the old 1-2 punch, right? It must really it must really sell tickets, you know, to just occur so very often in our media.
Yeah, another well, it's the role of the Jewish funny man, right? The funny man and of course, then the audience partakes in their own degradation because they laugh at it.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. But another movie, you might remember this movie. It's not as well known as the Graduate, but I think it's one of these movies again, which I think again is a very well produced movie, very funny in its own way, but very dark and disturbing. The Heartbreak Kid with Charles Grodin and Eddie Albert and Sybil Shepherd. And the storyline is there is where this Jewish guy marries a Jewish gal. They go down to New York. They go down to Miami for their honeymoon, and he meets Sybil Shepherd on the beach, falls in love with her, and starts dating her on his honeymoon with his sunburned wife back at the hotel. And he ends up divorcing his wife, asking for a divorce on their honeymoon, and chasing Sybil Shepherd back up to Minnesota, Wasp, Minnesota, and ends up marrying her. And in the storyline, it's one of these movies where you're watching and Charles Grodin, it's like a bad car wreck. It's just, he just ruthlessly goes after what he's going for. And he's obviously a Jewish character in the movie. And he, even the father, played masterfully by Eddie Albert, is this very powerful, imposing, but ultimately, weak father figure. Because he cannot protect his daughter from the from this interloper, this aggressor, and
predator.
He ends up even offering him money to go away, and shows how empty the wasp is, and he won't take the money. He wants the daughter, and he gets the daughter at the end of the movie. Did you ever see that movie?
No, I didn't. I really kind of I don't know when that movie was made, but I had
1972
was dropping out of like modern media at a certain point. I've seen some of the classics now because I have Netflix. And I think I forced myself to watch this stuff. I watched The Graduate like last year, I think.
Yeah, I would recommend to watch the original Heartbreak.
I will, actually, now that
original,
you mentioned
it. Original, The Heartbreak, not the remake, the original, 1972, with Charles Grodin. And it is, it's just one of these movies made for that era again. And it's called kind of a quintessential Jewish movie, Jewish comedy, it was called at the time. And again, the patriarch, the wasp patriarch, the Christian patriarch, is ultimately presented as a sort of he can do nothing. He's powerless, impotent to protect his daughter from this. Yeah. And he goes up to waspish, Germanic New York. I mean, sorry, Minneapolis, and just runs circles around the stupid goyim. It's one of these movies.
Sounds like a great film. I can't wait to
But
get
it's one of these
it.
Movies where, again, before I was really conscientious of it, I just watched it. Like I said, this is just a dark comedy. But again, it's assault on anything that is decent. Even with the father's pleas, when he makes his intentions clear to his daughter, intentions towards his daughter, the father makes a plea towards basic decency and the sanctity of marriage, and it's mocked. And of course, the screenplay is written by one Neil Simon.
A one-man cultural cesspool.
Yeah,
but he was so witty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there's other kinds of comedy that is very vicious. It's based on sort of symbolism that people don't get. I was just going to give like an example of it in the Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. You have a guy who kills people with a nail gun, right? I think he's representing basically the Jewish Messiah that the Romans killed, right? Because he nailed him to a cross. And this guy, he's a divine character, Anton, has a rumbly special effects voice, and he has his nail gun. So he's reaping vengeance, for having been crucified. I mean, this is the typology. But here, there's a passage in it that I just wanted to read, not too long. And it's two characters are talking to each other in sort of toward the end of the movie. And one guy says, these old people I talk to, if you could have told them that there would be people in the streets of our Texas town with green hair and bones in their noses speaking a language they couldn't even understand, well, they just flat out wouldn't have believed you. But what if you told them it was their own grandchildren? Well, all of it is signs and wonders, but it don't tell you how it got that way, and it don't tell you nothing about how it's fixing to get neither. Sorry for the weak, Southern accent. But you look at that, and you can see that it's obviously, they're praising the destruction of culture, right? It's like the guys are talking about, this is just amazing. And they use the expression signs and wonders, which is, basically a religious New Testament expression. But try to look at that statement just from the lens. I mean, from the perspective that I would ask of it is from hatred toward Gentiles. If you see that statement, then you can really get how vicious the comedy is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they know that this has been their accomplishment, right? The Coen brothers and all of the people that they are related to. I mean, you look at like the Great Lebowski, I believe it is.
The Big Lebowski.
The Big Lebowski. And you have the character, the dude.
The dude,
right?
Yeah.
Now, this is it's a mockery of Southern California culture. They go to different areas like Minnesota or whatever, and they will mock the culture, ridicule it.
Oh, Fargo, but, yeah.
Yeah, Fargo. Well, the dude has an expression. Jeff Bridges played a character, and he says, the dude abides. the dude abides. Well, you have to remember that, you know, at that time there was a bumper sticker saying Jesus lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the dude is a lampoon of the character in the Gospels. And then you have the identity problem, which, you know, goes into, there's more complicated typology, but you can see from a certain perspective that what is in back of the comedy is real hatred, right? Dangerous level of hatred, because it's not too far from, you know, ridiculing people with green hair and bones in their noses, and then looking at God as basically, you know, creating a plan, signs and wonders, to basically having like 911 symbolism, you know, and accepting of that event, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Coen brothers, unless I'm mistaken, actually had a 911 prefiguring in one of their films. I could be wrong, but I think that they did. And so that's, you know, that would be an example of just how dangerous, you know, the what this comedy is coming from. It's coming from a perspective where, you know, they would be aware of an event that's going to happen where people are basically going to be sacrificed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is not, you know, now you're sort of out of the era and zone of just cutting edge, of avant-garde, but you're into basically genocide. And so, again, this will, you know, be hopefully, just to whatever extent we can, just try to make people more aware, more sensitive to what the author is really saying with the comedy, right? The passage in the Coen brothers film, from a certain perspective, maybe it's funny, you know, they're just flabbergasted about the decadence of the modern generation. But then look at it from a different perspective. Look at it coming from, you know, a deep hatred, and basically proclaiming that this has been achieved. You know, it says, and then just look at the line. It goes, you know, it don't tell you how it got that way. Right. Secret society.
Yeah.
Don't tell you nothing about how it's fixing to get genocide. Right. So if you look at it from the right perspective, you get to see your reality gets much clearer. You get a lot better, you know, you get to understand the punchline.
And the decent people are impotent. That's the one thing you get from it.
Decent people just can't stop the nail gun guy or whoever, you know, anyone that they want. So that's, you know, that's why, I say you really need to pay attention to the material of people like the Coen brothers and Sarah Silverman, because, you know, it isn't too far from this perspective of comedy to, don't tell you how it got that way. Okay, that's the secret society, and don't tell you nothing about how it's fixing to get. Well, that doesn't sound too pleasant, does it?
Yeah.
You know? So people need to pay attention.
Now, of course, we're talking about comedy, Jewish comedy, particularly we're talking about here. But we have, he just passed away last week. It was this guy, Philip Roth, who wrote Goodbye Columbus and also later Portnoy's Complaint, which inspired Woody Allen's Annie Hall. And Philip Roth was known as sort of the informer to the Goyim, because he, in his novels, he revealed the contempt and the hatred that that many the Jews had for the Gentile culture, the Christian majority, and they didn't like the fact how he represented it. They didn't say it wasn't true. They just didn't like the fact that they revealed it. And in his novels, it's always this a Jewish guy who's defiling the Christian girls, the Gentile women.
Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah, Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is coming at a time of sort of this Jewish ascendancy, not just in literature, but also in comedy and in acting and these characters. I mean, you mentioned, Charles Grodin, of course, Elliot Gould, Woody Allen. Woody Allen, I think, was put on the cover of Time magazine in 1977 after Annie Hall wins Best Picture, the first comedy to win Best Picture. And these movies are really, they're celebrating the sexual revolution. And it's what they do is it's a mockery of Christian values and mores. The idea is, you know, it's certain rules governing sexual behavior are the same as, it's the same as not eating shellfish to them. And so basically eating, you know, having degenerate sex is the same as eating shellfish when you shouldn't, right? So it's no big deal with them when they make a mockery of these things. And it's used, of course, that's used, comedy mixed with sex is used to undermine the culture. And of course, Woody Allen is a great example of that. Again, some of his movies are masterfully done. Admit that. They're well, very funny in a way. But when you see the malevolence in it, it loses its charm. So, yeah. You know, it really does. But yeah, this, and of course, Philip Roth wrote extensively about, you know, defiling Gentile women, having hatred for the Catholic school children he'd see as they walk to school in their uniforms and these things. And in his book, Portner's Complaint, I think he calls her the monkey, his shiksa.
Yeah.
Shiksa, I think that's pronounced.
You just can't do Yiddish, man. I'm sorry. You're horrible.
I'm sorry.
We're going to have to get like maybe Noam Chomsky here to help you with the dialect.
But Woody Allen, and what happened was, it was what defined comedy. This is the comedy, Jewish comedy defined comedy. And even non-Jews, Jewish comedians started to act like Jewish comedians. That became the standard in the 1970s and these things. And so there was a large, it figured much in driving the culture in a certain direction. Mad Magazine, another Jewish publication. There is a, I was reading this in E. Michael Jones's book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And, of course, we mentioned Philip Roth, but it goes, the rise of Jewish humor meant the transformation of America into something Jewish. The transformation has been so complete that now an alternative is difficult to imagine. Is there an American humor that is not Jewish? Bloom is both fatuous and to the point when he quotes Charles Simic. It is impossible to imagine a Christian or a fascist theory of humor. By mid-20th century, Jewish funniness, says Bloom, had triumphed over the scenes and tropes sanctifying the New England legacy. And Alfred Kazin ratified this triumph in 1966 by dismissing earnest intellectuals and honoring such funny Jewish clowns and minstrels as the Marx Brothers, Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, Fanny Bryce, for establishing the Jew in the national consciousness as distinctly American figure, as a representative national entertainer. Philip Roth's alter egos are, in Bloom's words, cultural warriors eager to trespass on the hallowed ground of WASP dominance. Roth is the successor to Groucho Marx, standing poised to vandalize yet another monument to New England's Brahmin ascendancy, as Groucho did in Horse Feathers, by calling himself Quincy Adams Wagstaff. The eclipse of the Irish as the nation's comedian meant that what the Jews thought was funny was now funny for everyone. That meant the systematic violation of taboos. It was all goyish idiocy anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think even that statement is a bit of mind control, because when you talk about, like, you know, the America's WASP establishment, you know, that's just nonsense. Really, what you have is Masonic control. Who knows what is the actual ethnic background of these people, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have a DNA test in these guys. I mean, look at how many presidents are Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, or are just out and out Masons, right? So, you know, it's sort of like the idea of Ireland being a theocracy. It's not. It's a Masonicy, right? It's the Masons that have been in control. They just create lifetime actors and put them in front of the project so that people don't understand they've been enslaved. But, you know, so the America was built up basically to oversee the destruction of Germany. And then after World War II, then, you know, the bloom was off the rose, and then it just started to move toward a slave state.
Mm-hmm.
And has moved ever since, you know, in toward that direction. And so, you know, I always, I go back to like the Irish potato famine. You know, it's this, you know, the
You called it a potato famine, Joe.
oh, I know, and I thanks for correcting me. The Irish genocide, because that, you know, you have obviously the political leaders of Ireland are in on the deal, and then after the fact, you get to basically just record history the way you want it, so that the people that you genocided don't even, you know, can't even bear a grudge because it was that darn potato that didn't work. So this is kind of what's going on now, and one of the ways that history and culture are being transformed is through this comedian stuff, you know, because if you look at who owns all of the shows, even if you have actors that are not, you know, kind of clear-cut Jewish individuals. I mean, you look at like Saturday Night Live cast, right? You have Bill Murray and Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, but who's in back of this show? Who controls it? You know, if you look in the background of Lorne Michaels, the owner of the show and the controller of it, I mean, he's basically just another version of Norman Lear, you know. And then you have the comedy, which is funny and everyone watches, but it's always basically, you know, making white racism a real problem. You know, it's cutting edge in terms of gay rights and all this stuff. So they're always, you know, it's very subtly moving culture in the direction they want. And you see, the problem, Tim, is that we don't have a media. You see, this is the problem, and that's why when you really look at the power of the comedian and the power basically of like films and general entertainment, it's all under this secret society control. The normal human, you know, the European guy in the street or gal in the street, Tim, we're like the Irish during the Holocaust. We don't have anyone representing us. There is no media
No,
that.
I'm looking at Hollywood and the music industry and everything. It's all dominated by a certain group that has a certain point of view or values, and yeah, that's not.
Bimbo's initiation. You have a Masons and a Jewish guy. You know, where is like just the Irish Gentile guy with his cartoon, right? So there is no media for us, and the idea, like, you know, that statement you were reading where the guy's saying, oh, like it's a cultural warrior against WASP domination. That's nonsense. There never has been any WASP domination. The domination has all been Masonic, and then in back of that is Jewish financiers and Jewish culture warriors. That's where the power is.
But yeah, I
You
think
know?
there's certain phases as the WASP, a majority of America had become so brittle and weakened by the 1970s. They could you just have to push against it, it would crumble. Largely, that was driven by contraceptives because they had contraceptives themselves into a, and this is why they got so upset and worried about the Catholics who weren't contracepting, who weren't using contraceptives. And by the 1960s, and so they started promoting that with the sexual revolution and these things, and compliant judicial decisions with abortion and contraceptives and that. The you mentioned the media itself, and of course we get it in the 70s. That's when they start really pushing the degenerate stuff with sex, particularly on television. Comedy introduces this stuff. I mean, the issue of homosexuality was introduced via comedy. I remember an awful show. People was very popular. I never thought it was funny. It was Three's Company, right? Again, I think that was who was it produced that? Was it
I know it. I just can't recall it.
his daughter acted for? She was on like 90210, I think. What's his
Aaron Spelling, I
Aaron?
think.
Was it Aaron Spelling or
I don't
no?
think he actually he was I'm not sure he was the actual producer of it.
No, I forget
But
who.
Aaron Spelling was, you know, he had all of these
It
shows
might have been the
for.
Happy Days guy who did Three's Company. But that's when the topic of homosexuality, because you know the character Jack Tripper, I think, has to, in order to stay with the two girls, single girls. Mr. Roper, the superintendent or the landlord, is not going to let them because he's an old-fashioned fuddy-duddy guy who doesn't believe people should be cohabitating, and the only way he can stay there is if he convinces the guy that he's a homosexual. So he has to act that out. So this again introduces this in the form of comedy. And of course, it gets worse as you go into the 90s.
Look how subtle that is.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a real homosexual. He just has to play like a homosexual, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's sort of like Milton Berle with all when he would dress up as a woman, mm-hmm. Or Tom Hanks, and it was changing places or something. You know, you have the.
Bosom Buddies.
Bosom Buddies, exactly.
It was like Some Like It Hot, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And but the point is that they introduce the transvestite obliquely, right? Mm-hmm. It's never about a transvestite. There's some peculiar reason, you know, that the character is doing this, behaving like this. They're not real, you know, but the idea gets into the culture, becomes normalized.
And it's also absurd because it's obvious they're men.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, it's just ludicrous. But it's a way to get transvestitism into the mind, normalize it, make it become part of American culture, because you can see, Tim, where they're taking us. This isn't, you know, history unfolding. Go back to Gregor Loupchas, read the documents, you know, of his letters where he's talking about breaking down the minds of the children with the fairy tales. How this is going to be like a unique, it's going to be a better a communist individual than even, you know, like the communists will be, because they won't even know the difference between themselves and animals. That's how egalitarian, you know, and this is a guy who's in head of a Catholic nation's culture, mm-hmm. right? Cultural commissar. So that was, you know, and then also remember that the Frankfurt School basically becomes the most powerful, or one of the most powerful social forces in European culture following World War II. I mean, you know, it becomes cultural Marxism.
Yeah, and right? the fact that Hollywood is being run by people who trace their lineage back to Eastern Europe.
Sure.
And the other ones that control Hollywood. And these degenerates are going to control the entertainment fair of the nation.
Right. And so, you know, and then you get this double standard where the Gentile is characterized as racist, right? This is just kind of a set piece, mm-hmm. right? There's something wrong with the Gentile because he wants to retain his sort of ethnic identity. So that is bad. This is like where you get Jacob Schiff, you know, funding the NAACP. But then wait a second, old Jake. What about the Palestinians? What happened over here? Well, they're pretty dark skinned. How come these guys, you know, don't merit the same kind of all this fancy language about how wonderful the integrated world's going to be, you know, and when we break down the ethnic components? Well, you see, you can look at it like, well, gee, it's just sophistry, history unfolded, it's all accidental. Well, how about not? How about it actually makes a lot more sense that this is organized, you see? And if you take that step, if you take the step in understanding it as organized, the world makes a lot more sense, and also you can defend yourself a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay to transplant hundreds of thousands of Somalis into Minnesota. By golly, you better not acknowledge Palestinian nationhood or their rights, you know,
right
of return or these things. They build walls and they massacre dozens of protesters.
Like animals. I mean, yeah. You know, the event 2 weeks ago just makes me sick to my stomach. There's no outrage about
Joe,
that.
Joe, it did not happen because I was watching Fox News and I didn't hear anything about it.
God, so there it is.
So it's,
you know,
not happening. And if it does happen, they're all terrorists, even the children.
Yeah, they were terrorists, and they just shot them. So, you know, so, well, that's why I would ask our listeners to.
Now, there's no skits on Saturday Night Live making fun about.
Well, why isn't that? You know, that would be so great to have that is characterized as something. It'd be fun. You could get Sarah Silverstone to play one of the Palestinian people get shot. You know, I'm sure she can make a lot of witty remarks about it. But, you know, the thing is, it goes back to the intimidation. And I have just, you know, a hope, an aspiration that, you know, people look for ways to basically rebel from this process that we're in. And I think the best thing we can do at this point is to inside ourselves try to overcome the intimidation every day. And when opportunities come up in conversation, don't shy away from these subjects.
Well, I know people who you know, Catholics who sit back and enjoy Curb Your Enthusiasm. And Larry David makes a show where he urinates on the picture of the Virgin Mother. And this is funny. And then someone interprets it as a tear, so coming out of the picture. And so they're making fun of that. He gets away with this. Larry David, of course, a key writer for Seinfeld. And Seinfeld itself was a big pusher of, a very funny show in its own right, I admit. Very funny, very biting, and also very self-effacing in many ways. But that's where they get you. You mentioned another show in the aughts, maybe late 90s, was the show Will and Grace, and the effect that had on the culture and the sort of on the millennials. And of course, this is coupled with, you know, the advanced state of decay of the American family, which is going to lead to all types of sexual confusion, perhaps, and, you know, just identity crisis in these things, ethnic and even sexual. Which, you know, you think sexual is something that's biological. I can have identity problem there. But of course, we watch a show like Will and Grace, and then we refer back to go back 50 years into the authoritarian personality. Well, then you see it being laid out, right? And this is all
absolutely. Yeah. But just remember, when you see Will and Grace, and then the authoritarian personality, just remember that the Masonic vision in Brave New World is really where they're heading. They're, when you talk about, you know, so the family was breaking down at this time, there was sexual confusion, but remember, there was also the toxic assault was going on now. Mm-hmm. Sperm count was dramatically declining during this era. The bodies are becoming physically less healthy. Autism starts to pop up. You start having all of these estrogen mimicry, compounds appearing in people's bloods, mm-hmm. right? And so you're being hit in all ways. You're being made into, transformed into a gender neutral individual, and also intellectually weak. And the whole culture is basically going to embrace this, right? Neural diversity, gender diversity. And above all of this, of course, there's the meds, Soma. So in case you complain, or if you have, you know, a neurosis about being enslaved, well, no problem. Here's your medication. You know, like you have opioids through the roof now in America. So, you know, it's pretty serious situation. Pretty serious. It's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lot of, you can watch Annie Hall and laugh, but it's really not funny, Tim. It's not funny because in just like with the little passage I read from, the Coen brothers, when you look at the films in the right way, you can see that actually there's hatred and there's the acceptance of genocide and of basically replacing, you know, an entire world order, so to speak. So people need to be aware of this and as I said, the best response I can think of is to simply look at the intimidation in yourself and take that step to remove the intimidation so you can talk about it.
Yeah, and one thing is to recognize the cultural aggression. And once you recognize the cultural aggression and malevolence, and you identify the actors who's doing it, well, then you can have a conversation.
a debate about it. Right.
You know, it isn't just them funny ha ha ha. They're insulting you and they're demeaning you, and you're taking, just like as the through humor and same thing through sexual liberation, as you're collaborating. If you're in your own demise, your own degradation. And that's, you know, why that's what Hollywood is so much about. And that's
exactly.
I mean, that's the backdrop to the whole Harvey Weinstein thing, is the whole this the penchant that a lot of these Jewish movie producers have with going after, you know, Goyim women.
Yeah.
And there's an obsession there. And even that, I think there was an article written by, I think, it was about Harvey Weinstein's obsession with all, you know, most of his victims, if you want to call them that, I suppose. I think a lot of women are collaborating in it, but it basically just, that's been something that's been going on in Hollywood for a very long time. And, the key is to have the person participate in their own degradation, the satisfaction they get from that. And
sure,
you know, and you get that with humor. Yeah, it's very easy, because, you know, humor, it disarms you. And you know, at a certain level, you know, human sexuality, the issue, the question of sex is vulnerable to humor, because it's oftentimes very silly. People make fools out of themselves over it, so it's a great avenue for humor. But it's also, it's very easy to degrade, and you see it in movies and these things. You know, the kind of the just whether it's, you know, the college movies, National Lampoon, Animal House, and these things. You know, I remember back in my day, it was a show, this movie called Porky's. You know, just these crude sexual humor. You know, people go to these movies in droves, and they love it, but they're all kind of like being slimed in the process.
Yeah, I wish it was just being slimed. I mean, that's just a euphemism for being debased and being enslaved. You know, that's, you know, it's sort of like, you know, people talk about, you know, like a multicultural, or they have all of these expressions. And I always say, no, just insert easy to enslave.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you are thinking clearly about it. And that's what the people who go to, I didn't see Porky's, but I can imagine. I mean, it's the mind that leaves the theater has been weakened. Mm-hmm. It's easy to enslave, you see. And it's systematic. It just goes on 24/7. So for heaven's sakes, don't use mainstream media. I mean, to me, it's just as clear as a bell. You just never look at these movies. They, even if you're a specialist, or, you know, and you can defend yourself against them, why basically give them a chance to get at your subconscious, right? They know how to do that.
Yeah.
They study this. And so you don't know how you will even be able to resist the subconscious attack. Just stay away from them. Stay away from the entire mainstream media. From, you know, when the Oscars come on, you shouldn't know a single film. This would be perfect. You wouldn't know a single actor or actress. Or you wouldn't even know who Harvey Weinstein was. This is the right approach.
Yeah,
you have to just sequester the garbage and the weapons.
It should be Harvey who?
Harvey who? Right,
you know, and I think it was the last Academy Award movie I saw. I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, it's like Steven Spielberg, you know.
It's Titanic. I saw Titanic at the theater.
I saw Titanic. You know, and that's Cameron. I saw that film.
I hated it, but
I thought it was a horrible movie. But
I mean, special effects were fun, but I could have skipped the whole backdrop story. That it wasn't even a period piece, because, you know, it's just a teenage love story. Yeah,
what's the lead character, male character, annoying little twit? what is he? You know, the guy who played the lead in it. He was he drowns at the end.
Oh, the character's Jack Dawson. Oh, I know who you're talking about.
But who's that actor? I mean,
yeah, that actor. Yeah,
it was so irritating. I was actually hoping he would drown. I mean, that's how bad it was. I just thought, God, he's so irritating. When will he get out of the picture? You know,
well, he was
just
later, like in the Wolf of Wall Street. And
yeah, he has some kind of like oligarch connections. He's always gets all of these roles.
Well, that's Scorsese, and Scorsese's job is there as sort of the. He's the little Italian, that kept Italian there in Hollywood. He's there to insult Christianity, and he gets
You know, he comes across as an Italian. It's like a Coppola. But I'm telling you, they're Masons. They are not, these are, you call them Christians, put an asterisk, you know? I mean, like...
Scorsese had like a real debased lifestyle. He left his wife and was hanging out with Robbie Roberts in the 70s, cocaine, chasing... So, and then he had, his career was headed down the toilet, and he did The Last Temptation of Christ, and then he comes out, you know, with Goodfellas, a movie which was I thought it was great, one of those great gangster films. But then what's his job is? His job is to make Americans associate organized crime with Italians and not Jews.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, so I just, I'm sorry.
With Coppola and The Godfather, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, Coppola I know is a Mason. You can see it in the films he does and in other areas that I've studied him. Scorsese, I haven't done any research into the guy, but I'm sure he is. So, you know, and that's how they get, you know, you don't have people who have backgrounds that the secret society, the ruling Masonic Jewish oligarch system in Hollywood, that they can't are completely rely upon, right? They don't, you know, it's not like they control them. They don't need to because they are part of the process.
Yeah.
They're already inside the club. And so you don't even have to think about, you know, how do we get Coppola to, you know, to create Apocalypse Now. And, you know, I mean, you don't have to worry about it. He's inside the club. This is what he's going to be heading toward. It's like George Lucas.
Well, that's a lot of what the sexual revolution was about, was sort of changing the operating system that is America, you know, where so this broad Christian, I guess, Protestant Christian ethic that pervaded society and kept public morality, maintained public morality. But that was around the 1960s. It was changed. The operating system has changed, and sexual revolution became became mainstream. It became how most people think and feel about these things. That's the default position most people have now, the radical positions that would have been radical around the 1964, 65. Now they've internalized it to one degree or another. That's largely how feminism has the most effective. It's not as if everyone's running around acting like Gloria Steinem or Gloria, you know, Betty Friedan. No, they just internalize just enough of it. And this is kind of like what we said about Aleister Crowley, is this, his function and the function of his acolytes is sort of like a chemical concentrate that's put into the well of society, and it's toxic enough where it does the job, but it's diluted, but nevertheless it does the job because we internalize enough of it that society is degraded and, you know, it's changed in
absolutely
sort of satanic direction.
Yeah, and when you see Crowley, basically, you know, in back of people like Tim Leary, the Beatles, right? As you say, he casts such a long shadow, right? He suddenly is, you know, all of these people, why in the world are they, you know, basically, you know, kind of in his world? Well, it's like you say, it's an alchemical business, right? It's just in mysticism is that kind of demonic mysticism. You don't need to have a whole lot of it inserted. It's going to help basically normalize the things which are not as risque as, you know, satanic masses, for example.
Yeah, and also like black, you know, understanding magic or black magic. It's the idea of to have an incantation of words and have those words have power. And that's if you want to boil it down to that. And obviously, if you look at that, that's what these things, you look at music and the lyrics and music attached to a particular tune. And again, this is some of the things, this is something I wasn't, you know, really aware of or conscious of up until fairly recently. Just the, you know, rock and roll music, the power of the 60s music scene and the lyrics. Today, I was at, you know, a relative's house, and they were playing songs, you know, listening to the songs. And my brother has that Alexa system. And they were putting songs into the Alexa, and they were listening to songs and the lyrics. And I said, well, listen to the lyrics. I said, yeah, I don't like that. I like the tune. I said, but that's the power.
Exactly.
You start saying the tune over, and it's in your head. And that changes society. I mean, that's the effect of these rock figures, these rock idol. That's not
rock idol.
That's not a coincidence that they use the term rock idol.
No,
because we do worship at their feet, and we imitate them in one degree or another.
It gets past the conscious. It goes right into the subconscious. It becomes a lyric that basically produces moral perspective. You don't even know it's in there working. Mm-hmm. You know, they studied the unconscious so thoroughly to try to learn how to get at it that you have to always just be aware that the attack could be going on. And so that's why you don't go to movies. You don't watch films, right? I mean, you just don't. You just, I'm sorry. People say it's such a great part of culture. It's not. Bad for your head. Develop mm-hmm. other pastimes, exercise. And, you know, I mean, man, I'm a scratchy record, but
same thing with the TV. Put that thing in everyone's house.
Just get that the hell off.
Yeah. And the other day we were just talking, my brothers sitting around and some of my brothers and my nephews were there. And my kids were there. They were in my brother's pool. And they're talking about millennials and the problem with millennials and how they're cut off culture. They know very little about what happened before them. They're very not interested. They're only interested in something that occurred in their life. And I was like, well, it's true to an extent. That, you know, it's tough to make a generalization, but it is generally true how they have very little cultural reference points outside their immediate experience or interest. Whereas perhaps in previous generations, because of how people lived, they were exposed to multiple things, you know, in history and culture, these things. Well, that's because look at the media. I was saying, well, look at the people's, they're atomized now and they're segregated. Everyone, look at media. What's the time when people's entertainment fair was one TV set? So you were forced to watch what your parents were watching. It wasn't something you might not be immediately interested in because you're a child. Well, now the child can go off and watch things on the computer or on his phone and not be forced to ingest other people's idea of entertainment or music or culture and these things. You know, you ask so many millennials if they knew who Cary Grant was. And so, who's he? Well, he died long before I lived, so it doesn't matter. Really? Is that your outlook on life? My point was, well, look how they're increasingly atomized because of the entertainment. There was a time when people lived in intact families with extended families, with grandmother there or grandfather there, or they saw their grandfathers a lot. Society was less mobile, perhaps. So you had living around family, so you got exposed to their music and the things they talked about, just around the dinner table, the conversation around the dinner table. People don't even have those anymore. So it's the lifestyle. It's the lifestyle that's been created for them by the culture that we talk about. Exactly. This culture has been created purposely to atomize people, weak people, so they don't have that influence. So now they
are brave new world, man. Yeah. Brave new world. There's just no family.
Yeah.
The state produces the children. The children are conditioned, you know, in terms of their perspective, and they're stratified into neurologic diversity.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is what is going on now. This is real time. This is exactly what's happening. And you know, and Junior, he won't give up the iPhone and watching pornography for 10 minutes even to come and eat dinner, mm-hmm. you know? So this is the, you know, if you're a parent, you just have to step in. I wouldn't let, you know, I wouldn't let a kid have an iPhone. I think it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy idea to let them have those things.
Yeah. It's overloaded sensories with
this. Exactly. And it just gives them unlimited, access to cultural degenerate elements, you know. So just take it away. You say, look, read a book.
Yeah,
something like that.
So. Okay, Joe. I think we covered it.
Yeah, man, I thought it was a pretty good covering of. We didn't tell many jokes, but maybe next week we will. So, okay.
Well, it turns out comedy is a very serious thing. So
it's a very serious subject. Yeah. Anyway, have a great week, and I'm looking forward to another episode of Powers and Principalities next week, buddy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tim. Bye-bye.
Good night.